This is the April 1997 edition of Functional Medicine Update, Volume 16, Number 4. Side 1 of this month's tape features a report on the risk factors to ischemic stroke, plus an update on antioxidants, including vitamin C, zinc, green tea extracts, resveratrol, and vitamin E. Other topics on Side 1 will include plasma homocysteine as a marker for heart disease risk, and dietary fiber. Our interview on Side 2 of this month's cassette is with Drs. Jonathan Wright and Alan Gaby. We will conclude this month's edition of FMU with an update on the trace mineral selenium. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland with the April 1997 Functional Medicine Update.
A reminder, this is the last month before our fourth International Symposium on Functional Medicine at the Ritz-Carlton Resort in Aspen, Colorado. And as the program has come together, I'm very excited to see the workshops and the plenary sessions seem to be moving in integration very nicely. And I think we're going to get some spirited discussion and really have some interesting clinical takeaways. So if you haven't made your reservations as of yet, I suggest strongly you give us a call at 800-843-9660 and do so. This month in Functional Medicine Update, we have the pleasure of having Dr. Jonathan Wright and Dr. Alan Gaby, two well-renowned experts in the field of nutritional medicine, as our clinicians of the month. And I think every time that they have been on PMU, now Functional Medicine Update, in the past, it's always been hailed as one of the most clinically interesting clinician of the month interviews that we are fortunate to incorporate. So I think you will, this month as well, not be disappointed in the type of information shared by Dr. Wright and Gaby on Side 2 of this month's tape. In preparation for their clinician discussion, I want to talk about some specific areas this month that will be focus discussions. The first has to do with amino acids and some of the recent things that are coming out on amino acid analysis and the value for looking at amino acids in plasma or urine as prognostic markers. And this will be a theme that I will weave through this month's Functional Medicine Update on several different topics. Secondly, we will be talking about the relationship of antioxidants to certain types of risk factors and trying to give you an update as to some of the mechanisms and clinical applications and tricks that are coming out to use antioxidants effectively in clinical practice. And third, there will be a hopefully insightful review of the current information related to obesity and new understandings in weight management and the focus on leptin and insulin insensitivity over the course of this next few minutes. Let's start with talking about risk factors to ischemic stroke and its relationship to excitotoxic amino acids. A number of years ago, Dr. John Olney, a neurotoxicologist, brought to our attention the fact that there were certain amino acids that could induce a neurotoxic effect, particularly in sensitive individuals like children. Amino acids like glutamate and aspartate at high levels could be seen as neuroexcitotoxic amino acids that could overly stimulate the receptor sites on the neurons that are related to a neuroexcitation. In a recent paper published in The Lancet, volume 349, page 79, in 1997, there's a report of a very interesting study looking at 556 consecutive admissions to the emergency unit for individuals who went on to have ischemic stroke. In this particular study, what they found was a very close correlation between elevated levels in their plasma of the amino acid glutamate and later appearance of acute stroke. The suggestion is that one of the first steps that relates to the initiation of ischemic stroke is the increased level in the plasma and the cerebral spinal fluid of the excitotoxic amino acid glutamate, which then precedes the actual onset of the stroke by up to 48 or more hours. This is an indication, once again, that the balance of various amino acids that control neuroexcitation and neurological function may be markers for various aspects of neurologic function. As you recall, the glutamate pathway, as relates also to the aspartate pathway, through the NMDA receptor sites, N-methyl-D-aspartate pathway, that's the receptor site on the surface of neurons, codes for the ionophoric activity across the membrane, where calcium then can be taken up across the membrane, entering into the cell, resulting in an activation of the inducible form of nitric oxide synthase, producing from arginine then the amino acid arginine within the cell, nitric oxide, which then can combine with superoxide to form peroxynitrite, and an oxidant stress redox shift occurs, which then uncouples mitochondrial function and leads to increased apoptotic damage to the neuron. It's a long-winded explanation that basically says neuroexocytotoxicity relates to neuronal burnout. As Dr. Sen pointed out in his article on Parkinson's disease in the journal Neurology last year, it is as if the brain is on fire, to use a metaphor. And so the elevated levels of certain neuroexcitotoxic amino acids, like glutamate, may be indicative, therefore, of alteration in this activation pathway and signal progressive changes that later could be seen as stroke. I think a very interesting, again, emerging view of how our neurologic system maintains the balance between arousal and inhibition, looking again at amino acids as markers for activations or alterations in these pathways. Another amino acid that's certainly been in the news is the tryptophan metabolite melatonin. Melatonin, as you know, is a very interesting messenger molecule. It's actually in and itself not an amino acid. Its structure is N-acetyl-5-methoxytryptamine, but it is a derivative of the amino acid tryptophan. It was actually 3 centuries ago the French philosopher René Descartes described the pineal gland as the seat of the soul. But it was actually not until the late 50s, that melatonin, the principal substance secreted by the pineal gland, was identified. A very recent article that you probably saw in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled Melatonin in Humans, this is the first issue of the year, volume 336, page 186 in 1997, the author talks about the physiology and pharmacology of the pineal hormone melatonin. It was first identified in bovine pineal extracts on the basis of its ability to aggregate melanin granules and lighten the color of frog skin. More recently, it's been found to be very important as a light-dark circadian rhythm hormone that is secreted by the pineal gland and has impact upon sleep and circadian rhythms, mood, sexual maturation, and reproduction, and may actually have also impact upon anti-proliferative effects within the body, immune response, and even possible effects upon biological aging. In sleep, it appears to have an effect of increasing propensity for sleep. It also has a hypothermic effect at pharmacological doses. In circadian rhythm, it appears to control the light-dark cycle and reset the biological clock of the body. In mood, it appears to have a possible role in cyclic mood disorders, seasonal affective disorder, for instance, or SAD, and certain forms of depression. It also appears to inhibit reproductive process and has a very close relationship with the estrogen balance in a woman, and this may explain some of the differences in reproductive cycles and menstrual cycles in women who live in northern latitudes where there is much more dark, and the effect then on the pineal of darkness has an adverse effect or a different effect upon the secretion of melatonin. We know that light plays a very principal role in actually inhibiting the secretion of melatonin, whereas dark has an effect on stimulating the secretion of melatonin. Melatonin then has an effect upon blocking estrogen secretion. We can then talk a lot about the normal light-dark conditions, its melatonin relationship, and biological clock relationships. But I think one of the interesting parts of this story is that as melatonin is increased and there is a move in the circadian rhythm towards sleep, there is also an alteration in metabolic activity, and melatonin serves in the brain apparently as a free radical scavenger. Dr. Russell Reiter has done extraordinary work on melatonin as an antioxidant. Melatonin seemed to be more effective than other known antioxidants such as mannitol, glutathione, and vitamin E in protecting against oxidative damage. And therefore, melatonin may provide protection against diseases that cause degeneration or proliferative changes by shielding macromolecules in the nervous system, particularly DNA, from oxidative injuries. This is still an area of very interesting research, which has not certainly been completed, but it is very suggestive that melatonin during sleep has an important role to play as a brain antioxidant, suggesting that sleep has a reparative effect upon brain chemistry in some senses. As pointed out in this article, there are many studies on the effects of exogenous melatonin on sleep. Kramer et al. In 1974, the first report in 15 normal subjects, a single dose of 50 milligrams intravenously of melatonin resulted in sleep onset latency being decreased. Volrath in 1981 studied 10 subjects with a single dose of 1.7 milligrams of melatonin intranasally given during daytime and induced sleep. Lieberman, in 1984, did a study with 14 normal subjects with a total dose of 240 milligrams of melatonin intravenously, 80 milligrams given three times over a two-hour period. This is during daytime, and it reduced alertness, increased fatigue and sleepiness. In light of work today on this melatonin relationship, certainly 80 milligrams given three times would be considered extraordinarily high. Dalitz et al. Studied 8 patients with delayed sleep phase syndrome, a single dose of 5 milligrams orally, given at 10 p.m. for 4 weeks, and they had an earlier onset of sleep and a wake-up time in this study. This was a 1991 study. In 1995, Heimoff et al. Studied 26 elderly subjects with insomnia, single dose of 2 milligrams given orally. This was a sustained release in one group and a fast release in another, given 2 hours before bedtime for a week. And there was increased efficiency and duration of sleep in sustained release group and improved initiation of sleep in the fast release group, suggesting a kinetic relationship of uptake and utilization of melatonin. Garfinkel did a study in 1995 with 12 elderly subjects with insomnia, again single dose of 2 milligrams orally, given at night for 3 weeks, increased efficiency of sleep. Oldani, a 1994 study with 6 patients with delayed sleep phase syndrome, single dose of 5 milligrams orally for 1 month with the advanced onset of sleep. Dollins, in 1994, 20 young subjects, single dose of 0.1 to 0.3 milligrams orally given at midday with increased duration of sleep, decreased sleep onset latency. Zanoff et al. In 1995, 6 young subjects, a single dose of 0.3 to 1 milligram orally given at either 6, 8, or 9 p.m., a decreased sleep onset latency and no effect on REM sleep. And lastly, Wortman and Zadanova in 1995, a study with 9 elderly subjects with insomnia, single dose of 0.3 milligrams orally, 30 minutes before bedtime, increased efficacy of sleep and decreased sleep onset latency. So the therapeutic dose range in sleep disorders is anywhere as low as 0.3 milligrams in these studies to as high as 5 milligrams. The message that is taken away from this seems to be ranges between 0.3 and 1 milligram appear to have efficacy when given about an hour before bedtime. In the area of sexual maturation and reproduction, again, melatonin seems to have an important role to play, particularly in women, in estrogen balance. Melatonin secretion does not change during the menstrual cycle in normal women. Substantial increases in serum estradiol concentrations do not alter melatonin secretion in infertile women with normal cycles. On the other hand, serum melatonin concentrations are increased in women with hypothalamic amenorrhea. So if you look at both animal and human studies, if you look at them in terms of their relationship to fertility, in fact, this is very much seen in animals that breed seasonally. Melatonin inhibits pituitary responses to gonadotropic releasing hormone or its pulsatile secretion. It seems, therefore, that melatonin does, in fact, have a fairly profound influence on hormone levels. In one study of normal young women, a very large daily dose of melatonin, this was certainly a therapeutic dose, around 300 milligrams, was given orally for 4 months, and it was found to suppress the mid-cycle surge in luteinizing hormone secretion and partially inhibited ovulation, and the effects were enhanced by concomitant administration of a progestin. In some countries, as you probably know, melatonin is being used partly as a birth control agent, so it does have some very profound effects upon pituitary hormones and secondary ovarian hormones. Well, the conclusions from all of this are that there seems that melatonin has a profound influence on sleep cycles. There is no evidence to support the contention that it has a hypnotic effect. Its peak serum concentrations coincide with sleep. Its administration in doses that raise the serum concentration to levels that normally occur nocturnally can promote and sustain sleep. Higher doses also promote sleep, possibly by causing relative hypothermia. Exogenous melatonin can influence circadian rhythms, thereby altering the timing of fatigue and sleep. Abnormally higher pharmacologic concentrations of melatonin in women are associated with altered ovarian function and anovulation. It is tempting to speculate, according to this article, that the hormone has an anti-gonadal or anti-ovulatory effect in humans, as it does in some seasonal and non-seasonal mammalian breeders. but this possibility has not yet been substantiated in humans. The anti-proliferative and anti-aging effects of melatonin are even more problematic at this point in time, and uncontrolled use of melatonin to obtain any of these effects needs to be preceded with caution given its profound influence on brain chemistry and neurochemical function. So I think that certainly we look at tryptophan melatonin interrelationships to sleep and to mood alteration, and we would come to the conclusion that there are some interesting things here well worthy of inspection, but certainly going to higher doses above, say, 5 milligrams, we might be working in a problematic area, and doses between 0.3 and 1 milligrams given before bed might have an effect on reducing sleep latency and improving sleep in individuals with various forms of insomnia. Let me move on, if I can, to another continued discussion that we've had as it relates to antioxidants. And the antioxidants that I would like to focus on here clinically are vitamin C, zinc, as it relates to its activity with superoxide dismutase, and catechins that come from various phytonutrient-rich products, and polyphenols from various plant foods that all serve as antioxidants. So let's first start with the vitamin C. I was very intrigued by a recent paper that appeared in Excerpta Medica that talks about the prevention of post-angioplasty restenosis with therapeutic doses of vitamin C. I think this is a most intriguing paper in the American Journal of Cardiology, volume 78, page 11 in 1996. As you know, restenosis after a percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty remains a significant problem. Despite success with a variety of agents in animal models, no agent has proved conclusively effective in reducing coronary restenosis after this procedure in humans. Antioxidants offer the possibility of attenuating the process of restenosis after angioplasty through their ability to both reduce the progression of atherosclerotic plaque formation and to favorably influence wound healing. Vitamin C is a natural antioxidant found, as we know, in human blood plasma and has a physiological effect on preventing oxidative modification of low-density lipoprotein and atherogenesis, as we have defined in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. In this particular study, 119 patients were enrolled in post-angioplasty evaluation of vitamin C versus non-vitamin C supplementation. A standardized method of data acquisition was used to ensure accurate reproducibility of the angiograms, and patients were evaluated over a period of 1 year after their angioplasty procedure. The amount of vitamin C that was used in the treatment group was 500 milligrams per day divided in 3 doses. For many of us, that would be considered to be a reasonably benign level and certainly not a therapeutic dose. So one might question the results of the study partially on the basis of the amount used. However, the results were, I think, quite remarkable, in that there was a significant improvement in outcome in those individuals who received ascorbic acid versus those who received the placebo in prevention of restenosis. The results were very significant on a number of the clinical variables that they mentioned and that they evaluated. They come to the conclusion, therefore, that natural antioxidants, in this case vitamin C, appear to be able to adjust the ratio of prostacyclin to thromboxane, reducing platelet aggregation and vasoconstriction, and that this may account then for the demonstrable benefits that were seen in the patients after angioplasty who received vitamin C. They come to the conclusion that ascorbic acid at 500 milligrams per day level post-operative is a potent natural antioxidant and appears to be effective in attenuating post-angioplasty restenosis. Certainly a very interesting part of outcome improvement for those that are interested in managed care and cost-effective ways of reducing morbidity and increased expense for treatment. Another interesting paper that was recently published is a meta-analysis paper that reviews a number of previous papers on the relationship between zinc therapy and common cold symptoms. This is a review of all papers published since 1984, published in Alternative Therapies, Volume 2, page 63 in 1996. There are actually 8 publications that have appeared within the literature since 1984 that have reported a total of 10 clinical studies on the treatment of common colds with zinc. Zinc, as you know, has a number of very important roles to play as a central mineral within various metalloenzymes, enzymes such as DNA-dependent RNA polymerase, which is the rate-controlling enzyme for protein synthesis in many situations, and also in activating certain enzymes such as a zinc-copper form of superoxide dismutase, one of the important cellular antioxidants. You know, the reasons for the results that have been obtained from these 10 clinical studies, which have shown either positive or negative results, seems to be related to the dose and the mechanism by which the people were administered zinc. Beneficial clinical results that have been obtained since 1984 in the use of zinc in common cold include a double-blind study in 73 patients, 35 receiving zinc, 38 receiving placebo, in which the amount of zinc that was administered as a lozenge, this was a citrus-flavored zinc-containing zinc gluconate, actually lozenge, with glycine as the sweetener. The lozenge contained 50 milligrams of zinc, in one case 23 milligrams of zinc, in another case against a placebo, and in random distribution it was found that there was improved recovery from colds versus the placebo in those individuals that sucked on the zinc lozenges. In fact, the results of these studies average out to show that the duration of colds were reduced by about 42%, from 9.2 days to 5.3 days when individuals sucked on the zinc lozenges to enhance zinc status. Mossad et al. Did another study which they reported if they gave 13.3 milligrams of zinc gluconate in each 4.5 gram lozenge instead of the 23 milligrams, that they still got positive outcome in the reduction of the duration of the common cold. If you look at results of all of these studies plotted in a single plot of placebo versus zinc and the days of the symptoms of the cold, you'll find that there is virtually 35 to 40% improvement in those individuals who receive the zinc across all studies versus those that receive the placebo. So it appears as if things such as sneezing, drainage, and coughing were all very significantly improved by zinc administration. Also, sore throat seemed to have an improved outcome, and hoarseness. Scratchy throat, not much improvement in zinc versus placebo, but the other indicators of inflammation and viral infection seem to all be improved by the zinc supplementation. The data, if you examine all these 10 clinical trials together, then suggests that treatment of the common cold with ionic zinc in a lozenge form seems to be effective in reducing the duration and severity of colds, according to this study. The results of the Mossad study, even with a reduced dose of zinc at 13 milligrams, were better than the results previously reported by other investigators, and therefore at 13.3 milligrams per lozenge, giving 4 or 5 lozenges per day, you're still within the range of zinc intake that would not be considered excessive. When you get above 50 milligrams elemental zinc, you do have to concern yourself over the long term with potential suppression of HDL cholesterol and also suppression of copper. But on the short term, taken up to 50 milligrams per day as a lozenge form, one does not appear to run the risk of any adverse copper antagonism and other adverse effects. Again, I cite the paper as the Alternative Therapies November 1996 issue for this review. What about other antioxidants that are now getting into the news, like the French paradox, red wine polyphenols, or the green tea catechins that associate themselves presumably with lowered risk to cancer in countries where green tea catechins are commonly consumed? I was very intrigued to see a paper in the Lancet, volume 349, page 360 in 1997, where the investigators had looked at the oxidation of low-density lipoprotein, this is the LDL oxidation, in a model study with and without vitamin C, E, and green tea catechins. And what they found is a very powerful dose-response effect of green tea catechins in protecting LDL against oxidation. The antioxidant effect of green tea was greater than that of vitamin C, but about equivalent to that of vitamin E on a molar basis. And the antioxidant effect of green tea was not attributable to metal chelation, but was more related to the polyphenolic nature of the green tea catechins, which could intercalate with LDL and prevent oxidative damage to the lipoprotein. These findings obviously are relevant to antioxidant usage and safety, since green tea is a natural antioxidant that has been used in the most enduring of food cultures, the Chinese and Japanese tea. It may provide an alternative or at least part of the total approach towards improving redox protection against oxidative stress. You might ask, how much green tea catechin antioxidant protection is there in a beverage? That's an interesting question. Intake of a cup of green tea, about 100 milliliters, is reported to contain 50 to 100 milligrams of polyphenol catechins, equal to 1.6 to 3.2 millimoles per liter, which would be about 6,300 to 12,600 times higher than the dose used in this study published in The Lancet to protect against LDL oxidation. Therefore, depending upon absorption, as little as one cup of green tea per day could provide adequate intake of antioxidant polyphenols falling within this particular range. This paper, by the way, was authored by Dr. Mark Volquist and his colleagues at the Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, a gentleman that I've had the pleasure of meeting and who has been doing quite a bit of work over the years in nutrition and dietetics, and who I think is at the forefront leadership now and starting to look at the phytonutrient effects on antioxidant potential. Another interesting paper in the same area, which relates to the green tea story and the association of it to the red wine French paradox story. And you recall the red wine story is that the French, who seem to eat a very high level of fat in their diet, also consume high amounts of red wine, which is rich in these polyphenols, and it has been suggested that this may account for their lower heart disease incidence. And there is a big controversy about how to interpret the French paradox data, but certainly the story about polyphenols in red wine and grape juice is of importance. Well, in Science Magazine, you probably heard the extraordinary paper that was published, volume 275, page 218 in 1997. This is a very interesting study coming from the Department of Medical Chemistry and Pharmacognosy, College of Pharmacy, University of Illinois, Chicago, out of the collaborative work along with Dr. Farnsworth, who is a very highly respected pharmacognosist at the University of Illinois. This particular paper reports the activity of a antioxidant derived from grapes, a polyphenol, a phytoxylin called resveratrol. It's found in grapes and other food products, and it's been purified and shown to have very powerful anti-carcinogenic activity in assays representing three major stages of carcinogenesis. Resveratrol was found to act as an antioxidant and an anti-mutagen and to induce phase two drug metabolizing enzymes. Quinone reductase activities include the glutathione conjugase activities, and so what we're talking about, a phase 2 upregulator, and it also inhibited cyclooxygenase 2 and hydroperoxide formation, so it was also an anti-inflammatory agent as well. In model studies, it had the ability to block cyclooxygenase, and it also had an effect on lipoxygenase, which means it slowed down the formation of the pro-inflammatory 2-series prostaglandins. It also prevented the formation of the leukotrienes, and it had a positive effect on upregulating phase 2 detoxification enzymes. The results of this study seem to be consistent with the epidemiological studies that have suggested that coronary heart disease mortality could be decreased by consuming red wine that contains these polyphenols. It is conceivable that resveratrol plays a role in the prevention of heart disease as well as may help to prevent certain forms of carcinogen-induced cancer. It also was found that resveratrol seems to or inhibit platelet aggregation and coagulation. Obviously, it may alter eicosanoid 2-series synthesis, the pro-inflammatory eicosanoids, and favorably modulate lipoprotein metabolism. The ultimate conclusion, obviously, is that this substance really deserves further evaluation, that foods and non-alcoholic beverages derived from grapes should be considered as dietary sources of this important antioxidant and gene expression modulator. So again, resveratrol, I think what you see is an increasing number of papers talking about the therapeutic benefit of phytonutrients and their relationship to antioxidants and their relationship as gene expression modulators. Well, I'm talking a little bit about vitamin E and other antioxidants. Let me throw a plug once again for the important role that vitamin E can have in those patients that you are treating who are insulin insensitive and who may be suffering from higher degrees of oxidative stress with increased risk to neuropathies or nephropathies or ocular damage. These individuals are certainly producing more glycosylated proteins, the so-called Amadori reagent or Amadori reactions that has glucose reacting with the lysyl amino groups of proteins to cause them to be glycosylated. That is related also to the oxidative stress mechanism, because these glycosylated proteins can then have a further adverse impact on initiating NF-kappa-B-induced oxidation. All of this is long-winded. What does it have to do with clinical? As you probably recall, we have spoken in Preventive Medicine Update in 1996 about the important role that vitamin E given at 100 milligram per day doses seemed to have in prevention of damage to the nerves in diabetics. This was a clinical trial in which nerve conduction velocity studies were done, and also the accumulative glycosylated proteins and malonaldehyde, the breakdown of lipids by oxidative stress, were evaluated. And the 100 milligram per day intake of vitamin E appeared to be protective to the secondary side effects of insulin imbalance and dysglycemia. Well, a more recent paper in the same light comes from the Journal of Nutrition, volume 127, page 103 in 1997, in which they were able to find in a very well-controlled study that if you start feeding animals that are diabetic high doses of fructose in their diet, it further exacerbates their insulin resistance and produces a defect in the free radical defense antioxidant system, which increases oxidative stress. So the high fructose diets in these animals resulted in insulin resistance, more dysglycemia, more oxidative stress, and vitamin E supplementation was found to improve both insulin sensitivity in these fructose-loaded animals and reduce oxidative stress. Now, if you think of all the corn sugar products that we're consuming in our culture today that are high fructose corn sugar, and therefore the trend towards simple carbohydrate has been more and more towards fructose, and you tie that together with the insulin insensitive story that we are seeing emerge from Dr. Gerald Reaven, who is a presenter at the 4th International Symposium coming up in May, what we are starting to witness is ever-increasing risk then to dysglycemia and the oxidative stress and glycosylation reactions that can occur along with dysglycemia. My answer then is we need to take dietary steps to modulate insulin control and resensitizing the body to insulin, while we're also helping to protect against oxidative stress and the dysglycemic glycosylation reactions. And therefore, vitamin E appears to have a very important role to play. I'd also throw into this the evaluation of fructose intake. We've often thought of fructose as being a suitable non-insulinogenic sugar substitute for that of either table sugar, sucrose, or glucose. And now it's starting to be recognized that high-dose fructose may have its own adverse impact upon glucoregulatory machinery and increase, therefore, the oxidative stress reactions and insulin insensitivity. So therefore, what I would suggest is vitamin E, as well as dietary modification, might play roles in this process. How do you evaluate vitamin E status in your patients? Often we just measure plasma vitamin E as a kind of a rough measure of the status of vitamin E in that patient. However, we know that vitamin E actually works not within the plasma, but principally within cellular membranes. It's a lipid-soluble antioxidant, and therefore we ought to be looking more at where vitamin E resides, which is within membranes like the red cell membrane. We actually published papers back in the early 1970s on this, showing that vitamin E status clinically was more correlated with vitamin E intracellular membrane-bound levels than it was plasma levels. Well, this concept is further reinforced in a very interesting paper published in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 43, page 285 in 1997, where the investigators looked at plasma and erythrocyte membrane vitamin E content in asymptomatic hypercholesterolemic versus symptomatic hypercholesterolemic individuals, meaning people that went on to get stages of heart disease. And they found that the only real correlation you could get between hypercholesterolemia and symptoms through the vitamin E analysis was looking at the membrane-bound or erythrocyte membrane vitamin E. In people that were symptomatic, that were hypercholesterolemic, you had low intracellular or low membrane RBC vitamin E, although their plasma levels did not differ statistically in any significant level from that of the asymptomatic individuals. What this indicates is that we ought to be looking for these fat-soluble antioxidants at the place where they really are doing their work, which is within membranes, and not rely solely upon plasma levels. One of the other risk factors that we see for vitamin E deficiency, which is cholesterol-independent, and its relationship to heart disease, is the interrelationship that oxidative stress potential has to homocysteemia, and how homocysteemia, or the elevated levels of homocysteine in the blood, may also serve as a cholesterol-independent risk factor to heart disease as well. I think that this story is emerging very, very well over the last 2 years, even though it's been proposed for nearly 20 years that hyperhomocysteemia is an atherosclerotic risk factor. In the more recent paper that I've seen, which is volume 349, page 397 in 1997 in The Lancet, plasma homocysteine and cardiovascular disease mortality were looked at cross-culturally. And here is a plot of CVD mortality per 100,000 versus plasma total homocysteine. And there's a virtually linear relationship between plasma homocysteine, starting at levels in the plasma of homocysteine above about 7 micromoles per liter and going up to as high as 12 micromoles per liter. You see a linear relationship with increasing cardiovascular disease mortality. Japan has the lowest national average levels of homocysteine, somewhere around 7.5 micromoles, and Finland, which has the highest incidence of heart disease at 500 cases per 100,000 mortality, has 11.4 micromoles per liter. So Japan, which is less than 170 cases of CVD mortality per 100,000 at 7.4 micromoles per liter, goes up to as high as 11.5 in Finland, more than 500 cases per 100,000 at levels of homocysteine of 11.5 micromoles. So it appears as if it's a good prognostic marker for risk to cardiovascular disease. You might ask, what is the variation if you were to measure plasma homocysteine? What's the variation from day to day or week to week? Is the analysis accurate enough to really give you any meaningful clinical information? And that particular question was recently evaluated and the results published, again, in Clinical Chemistry, volume 43, page 141 in 1997. Short-term and long-term variability of plasma homocysteine measurement was reported. The short-term between-person variance was high, whereas within-person variances were relatively low, which suggests genetic heterogeneity, which we already have established for homocysteine control. But in any individual comparing themselves over serial samples, there was very little variability. A high reliability coefficient was seen an individual to individual. The long-term, more than 30-month reliability coefficient was actually quite good. There was one individual in the study who was an outlier that influenced the overall statistics, and when that outlier was taken out, the correlation was 0.82 inter-individual over the period of 30 months. They conclude that an individual's plasma homocysteine concentration is relatively constant over at least 1 month, and a single measurement does characterize the average concentration reasonably well and is an indication of relative risk upon which decisions can be made for treatment. And, of course, the treatment comes back to nutrition and nutritional pharmacology, and I was very intrigued to see that we had an eloquent plea for the members of the scientific and nutritional research community to write to the Food and Drug Administration and advocate that our grains be mega-fortified with vitamin B12 and folate to lower the risk to homocysteemia-induced atherosclerotic disease. This article goes on to talk about that implementation of this action for supplementation of grains with 25 micrograms of crystalline B12 per 100 grams of product to supplement simultaneously with folate at 140 micrograms per 100 grams of product will have major positive benefits not only in preventing neural tube defects, and also preventing nerve damage from folate mass pernicious anemia in fertile African-American women who are at risk, but it will also have the ability to help prevent millions of Americans from getting vasculotoxic hyperhomocysteemic-induced injury, which results in an enormous cost in heart attack, stroke, and other vasculotoxic morbidity and mortalities. Billions of dollars are spent in healthcare on these problems. The author estimates that by mega-supplementing the grains, that we might be able to reduce 20% of all heart attacks, 40% of all thrombotic strokes, and 60% of all peripheral venous thromboses if we can urge the FDA to support a standard that is supplementation of grains with B12 and folate at this level. And by the way, the author, who is a world-renowned expert in B12 and folate chemistry and physiology, goes on to point out that we really need to make sure we get more than just the RDA levels of B12. Because there are many ways that B12 could be antagonized. About 40% of B12 and 1/6 of folic acid is lost, for instance, in the presence of stomach acid along with iron. Thus, 25 micrograms of B12 taken orally translates into only about 13 micrograms of vitamin B12 surviving into the small bowel. Thus, the minimum safe daily oral dose becomes 25 micrograms of B12, even though you only need about 10 micrograms to ensure absorption of 0.1 micrograms, and only about 0.1 micrograms is required to prevent pernicious anemia. So this is a dose of 0.1 micrograms as the minimum dose. Up to 25, we have a safety margin then to protect against malabsorption of 250-fold in this recommendation. And I think you probably know that this very eloquent argument for mega supplementation of grains with folate and B12 comes from an expert who can speak with authority as to the necessity for this, and that's Dr. Victor Herbert. And I'm now quoting from his article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 65, page 572 in 1997, in which he is arguing for us all writing to the FDA in petition for supplementation of our grains with folate and B12 at higher doses than RDA. It was interesting to note, wasn't it, that even Kellogg's has gotten onto this with a full-page advertisement in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association in 1997, in which they introduced that folate, an essential B vitamin, now has been fortified in many of their cereal products, including Product 19, Special K, Frosted Flakes, Rice Krispies, and Corn Flakes, to ensure that individuals are going to be getting adequate folate. And, of course, Dr. Herbert's response is, let's also be equally concerned about fortification with vitamin B12, so we will not produce any masking of pernicious anemia and get the full benefits in lowering the risk to hyperhomocysteemic-induced arterial injury. Well, if we take this a step farther, we probably know that vitamin E, insulin, hyperhomocysteemia, oxidative stress, all these things are starting to look like they have much more clinical applicability than we might have thought a year ago, in which they were kind of isolated to the research labs and the more esoteric conversation. One of the topics that we've discussed for years in Preventive Medicine Update and now in Functional Medicine Update is the concept of glycemic index and its relationship to insulin balance and sensitivity, and also to oxidative stress relationships. It's been assumed that low glycemic index foods, which are generally foods of higher unrefined carbohydrate and balanced protein and fat with higher fiber, are those foods that lower the insulin demand and increase insulin sensitivity and thereby reduce the postprandial oxidative stress potential that might associate itself with insulin insensitivity. That has not been clearly proven in a human clinical study or evaluation, but recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 277, page 472 in 1997, such a paper was published, which I find very interesting, from the Department of Nutrition and Epidemiology, Harvard School of Public Health. In this particular paper, they looked at a cohort total of 65,173 U.S. women 40 to 65 years of age, and who were known to be free from diagnosed cardiovascular disease, cancer, and diabetes. They completed a detailed dietary questionnaire from which was calculated their usual intake of various forms of carbohydrate and dietary fiber. Dietary glycemic index was calculated and a glycemic load. During the 6 years of follow-up, 915 incident cases of diabetes were documented. The dietary glycemic index was positively associated with risk of diabetes after adjustment for age, body mass index, smoking, physical activity, family history of diabetes, alcohol, cereal fiber intake, and total energy intake. Comparing the highest with the lowest quintile, the relative risk of diabetes was about 1.37 times higher for the high glycemic versus the low glycemic group. There is a very interesting chart that is given in this paper, which plots relative risk to diabetes versus glycemic load of the diet versus cereal fiber intake, and shows that the lowest risk group is those that had the highest dietary fiber, and by the way, that would be fiber not very high, it's just greater than 5.8 grams per day, which for most of us would be considered a fairly low dietary fiber intake. They didn't break that out further to see if there would be even lower risk individuals above 5.8 grams per day in the study. And then they look at the lowest risk also being the individuals that had the lowest glycemic load, the lowest glycemic index of their total diet. I want to emphasize total diet, not glycemic index on a single food, but rather glycemic index on a total diet. So when they start looking at glycemic indices, their relationship to insulin sensitivity, the risk to non-insulin dependent diabetes, it appears as if dietary fiber, total glycemic load of the diet, do very closely correlate with relative risk to insulin insensitivity and non-insulin dependent diabetes. We'll be talking on side two of this month's Functional Medicine Update a little bit more about the relationship that this has to such things as obesity and to hypertriglyceridemia, but let's close if we can and move to side two. Well, every few years we happen to be fortunate enough to have the time, place, and synchrony of the universe such that we can get both Dr. Jonathan Wright and Dr. Alan Gaby in place by the telephone so that we can kind of do B-flat jazz in nutritional medicine with them. And we're very fortunate this month to have both Dr. Wright and Gaby with us. And it doesn't take much in the way of lead-in questions nor introduction to start this ball rolling. Both of them are fundamental contributors to the emergence and evolution of the field of nutritional medicine, and I'd even like to say patron saints of functional medicine. Dr. Gaby has been in practice for many years in Maryland, now out as the first chair professor at the Vassar University, giving courses both to naturopathic medical doctor students, Chinese medicine and nutrition course master's students, and doing research and writing a book. So he's his usual busy self. And Dr. Wright is in Kent overseeing a very large practice and clinic, and also actively involved in the natural medicine clinic in King County as a member of their advisory board. I know that both of you have had quite a bit of historical experience and interest in the trace mineral nutrition area, and one that's certainly on the marquee right now is selenium in the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA papers that have been published recently. Your history goes way back, well before these papers were published. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see this emerging selenium story, its relationship to immune protection and antioxidant effects, and how it fits into nutritional medicine?
Oh, thank you very much for having us on Functional Medicine Update this month, Jeffrey. This is Jonathan Wright. Just before we start to go over the selenium question, I'll cover the immune protection, and I'm sure Alan will chime in on the antioxidant. I'll say that Alan's first chaired professorship, you were on the modest enough not to mention that it was the Jeffrey Bland Chair, and Bastyr University and all of us in the natural medicine community really appreciate your making that possible, an endowed chair at Bastyr. Thank you very much. And we encourage anyone else who wants to endow a chair at Bastyr to do so. About the selenium story, it's been percolating along in small studies and here and there as just possibly being an anti-cancer item and just possibly being an antiviral sort of item. A lot of this has been drawn together by, of course, several people, but one of the people I've talked to the most is a professor, Taylor, at the University of Georgia Computational Center for Molecular Genetics. And how this gets into clinical practice is really not as complicated as it sounds. Dr. Taylor explains that in sequencing the genetics of certain viruses, he came to the conclusion, just by the mathematics of the sequences, that these viruses would produce, were coded for, I should say, the production of a selenoprotein. And he really had some puzzle as to what this was doing there. And to shorten this up, he's made a prediction that these selenoproteins produced by certain viruses actually act as brakes on the virus's reproduction, or, to put it another way, the virus makes its own birth control pill. However, when there is insufficient selenium around, then the virus does not make, of course, or the selenoprotein, and so the birth control pill that it's making for itself isn't there, and the virus goes wild. This, as Dr. Taylor says, it gives us a way that we can effectively, for ourselves and the people we're working with, help them, quote, live with, unquote, their viruses better. Even if we can't totally eradicate the virus from the body, if we can put the thing to sleep, as it were, then it's just not going to bother us so badly. Now, there was that research paper published from North Carolina, I believe, that showed that a Coxsackie virus, which was otherwise a benign virus, when it was run through, as it were, animals that were selenium insufficient, suddenly became quite virulent and, in fact, killed a lot of the experimental animals. And then after that, even when it was run through selenium-sufficient animals, it remained virulent. So apparently the lack of selenium and the lack of production of this repressor or whatever it is allowed the virus to go bad. There have been other studies on selenium showing that, for example, if one puts 15 parts per million, which isn't very much, selenium into the table salt and gives it to one group of folks over China and the other group doesn't get any selenium in their table salt, that the incidence of hepatitis goes way down in the group that gets selenium. The viruses that are inhibited, because certainly don't want to take the whole time with this, the viruses that inhibit themselves with selenium are the retrovirus group. This happens to include, and it's created a great stir, HIV-type herpes virus. Selenium has suddenly become real popular with HIV virus clubs, and it applies to just about all the other retroviruses, particularly the whole herpes family. For example, I found that adding sodium selenite, 250 micrograms twice daily, to the program of people who have recurrent outbreaks of herpes simplex, virus genital, or oral mucocutaneous, really slows down that herpes virus. And we have in our antiviral IVs now, for anything that's retroviral, let's say hepatitis virus or whatever, we have added about 500 to 600 micrograms of selenium per time. It's been additionally helpful in stopping these viruses. Now, I've expanded on all these antiviral uses at our seminar, and it's on our seminar tapes, so I'm sure you'll have Professor Taylor on in the future. I'll just shut up about the antiviral effects and let Alan go on to, or ask Alan to go on, please, to the antioxidant effects and other treatments for herpes and
right.
so forth.
Okay, thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Jeff, for having us on. Well, Jonathan actually covered most of the stuff I know, but I'll try to add a few things here. Actually, the Coxsackie virus study was quite fascinating to the extent that the viruses actually mutated. In the selenium-deficient environment, they mutated, and when the study was repeated 3 months later in a different mouse, they showed the identical mutation on the DNA that they had seen 3 months before. So evidently, there is a very powerful interaction between nutritional status and the virulence of organisms, and this may extend to a lot of other areas. For example, in China, there's a condition called Keishan disease, where they get a severe and often fatal cardiomyopathy, and it was determined that if the people are supplemented with selenium, this is an area where selenium in the soil is very deficient, and if they supplemented with selenium, then people didn't get this disease. So one wonders, what is the relationship? We know that Coxsackie virus can cause myocardial problems. We know that selenium deficiency causes Coxsackie virus to become virulent and mutate and cause cardiac problems. And perhaps this Keishan disease that we see in China is due to a virulent Coxsackie virus. And it brings up the exciting and broad possibility that perhaps many of the other diseases that we attribute to infectious etiologies may in fact be to other problems. They've shown, for example, that in the mouth, a pyridoxine-deficient environment causes cavity-producing bacteria to proliferate, whereas in the presence of adequate vitamin B6, these organisms are competed out and non-cavity-producing organisms occur. So it's just a really exciting new area for research. As far as the cancer studies, I was aware of some studies going back through the old literature. There were two studies from the 1930s on the effective treatment of cancer with selenium compounds. This was not the typical sodium selenite. They were actually fairly complex selenium molecules. But these folks had apparently been doing this for a long time and getting some reversal of cancer, and then it died out. And now we see in a few weeks ago in JAMA that there is at least a very powerful preventive effect using a small amount of selenium for a number of different cancers.
One of the things, Alan and Jonathan, I found very interesting in this emerging story about selenium and herpes is the connection back to the things that you've talked about years ago, lysine and its use therapeutically for the treatment of herpes, and how that might relate to the nitric oxide story and how that interrelates then to glutathione peroxidase and other selenoproteins. But this arginine conversion to nitric oxide, which is antagonized by increased intake of lysine, and how that relates to selenium, it seems like it's tying a story together that might be very interesting to understand both the mechanism of lysine, how that ties to nitric oxide, and how that ties to oxidative stress and ultimately selenium and these viral mutations.
It may very well be true. One of the things we tend to forget, though, is that arginine does have a lot of benefits in the body. For example, we can treat fertility in males using arginine. Now there's some studies that show congestive heart failure improves with arginine. So when we think lysine is good and arginine is bad, we have a tendency to go overboard. And there are some studies, actually, that have shown that the combination of lysine and arginine together enhance immune function in children who get sick all the time, whereas either one alone didn't have much effect.
There's actually also, we put it in this month's Functional Medicine Update, it's very fortuitous that you mentioned this, that arginine has been reported a month ago in Free Radical Medicine and Biology in a clinical human trial at 500 milligrams taken twice daily to reduce the oxidative stress in diabetics because it tends to reduce malonyldehyde and other oxidation byproducts. So I don't want to give arginine a bad name in that discussion, but it seems there's possibly some interrelationship in this whole selenium story and the arginine-lysine connection. Let me, if I can, go on and talk a little bit about some of the other things that are in the news right now. The New England Journal of Medicine just had a very interesting report on melatonin, which, again, you two have been speaking about for many, many years prior to actually getting into the public eye. Give us your update on melatonin.
Alan?
Well, I think melatonin is very good for older people who can't sleep. And I think it's also good for people with advanced cancer. There are several studies done out of Spain where the survival of metastatic cancer is greatly increased with a level of about 20 milligrams of melatonin per day. And then there's two case reports on the reversal of sarcoidosis using that level, about 20 milligrams of melatonin. Concerning whether it's an anti-aging compound or whether the antioxidant benefits are worth taking it, I'm not yet convinced that the average person should use melatonin. I have a concern that it's a powerful hormone that's sort of high on the hormone chain, as it were, way up in the pineal gland, and that also there's a possibility for contamination. The tryptophan contamination problem has been corrected, but melatonin is a complex molecule, and I wonder whether the benefits really outweigh the risks for just the average healthy person at this point.
Well, there's also a single study out there showing that melatonin reduced intraocular pressure in folks who had glaucoma. I don't believe that was a controlled study, but it's fairly intriguing, as we know that the glaucoma age group is just exactly the insomnia age group, and melatonin insufficiency may be perhaps impacting both there. I'm a tiny bit more enthusiastic about the use of melatonin for people past 40 to 45 years of age than Alan is.
Well, I said old people.
Well, just because you might be under that. Because the mostly the animal studies, obviously they're not long-term people studies, but animal studies in animals past animal middle age uniformly appear to indicate that melatonin is perhaps a life extender and for sure an immune booster and an anti-cancer substance. Used in small milligrammage, and if we just simply pay attention to how we feel when we wake up in the morning, because of course too much melatonin is going to give us that sleepy hangover feeling, I think that for those of us who don't have the time to wait around to find out what the various long-term double-blind placebo-controlled studies say, that on balance it's probably something to consider, 1-2 milligrams or something like that at nighttime. I really discourage folks who are under that, quote, magic middle age, unquote, though, from using melatonin except in exceptional circumstances.
Well, let's shift to another area of replacement therapy, which has certainly equally been in the news, and that's the DHEA pregnenolone story. Could you tell us how you see this evolving and how it relates to clinical practice, the DHEA versus melatonin?
That's one that I'm much more enthusiastic about. There's an age-specific relationship there. People over 60 are very frequently deficient in DHEA, and replacement of it in physiologic levels, which in my opinion is somewhere between 5 and 15 milligrams for women, and between 10 and 30 milligrams per men.
And I'll go maybe 5 to 10 milligrams higher sometimes.
Sure, okay. And that can clearly reverse some of the manifestations of aging. People put back muscle mass, their wrinkles get better, their facial appearance is better, they just look alive, their depression goes away, their memory's improved, appetite, everything like that. So there is some indication for age-related hormone replacement. And then the other major indications, there's some situations where menopausal hot flashes and related symptoms will improve. That's typically in a woman whose DHEA level is near the bottom or below the normal range at menopause.
I'm going to get on a little laboratory soapbox here and say that if we're going to be using DHEA therapeutics, we absolutely need to be following up not only DHEA levels, which we might be finding in serum, but we need to be monitoring the downstream metabolites of DHEA, the two that are most easily measured on, in this case, a 24-hour urine. And certainly that's done by the lab I consult for, Meridian, but it's also done by other laboratories. are etioglanalone and androsterone, and those routinely come up on a 24-hour urine for steroids, for androgens, and so forth. I have seen over and over again folks who have either gone to the health food store and taken a nice charge of DHEA, 50 milligrams, 100 milligrams, whatever, or who have been advised by a practitioner to take those kind of doses and have had a follow-up blood test, and it's within the normal range, so what's the problem here? And I'll ask them, please do a 24-hour urine, which shows you not only your DHEA, but also your etioglanalone and androsterone. And that 24-hour urine will come back with the DHEA in the urine within the normal range, usually high normal, but the etioglanalone and or the androsterone are 3 to 4 times normal. And I just can't, at this time, believe that if we take enough of a hormone to raise its metabolites to 3 to 4 times normal, that is going to be healthy over the long run. I do get the question, what's going to happen to me if my etioglanalone is 4 times normal for the next 5 years? And my answer is always, do you want to find out? I don't. When we're doing functional medicine, that implies physiologic medicine, and we want to keep not only the precursor hormone within the physiologic range, but we also want to keep those downstream metabolites within the physiologic range. So I always recommend to folks, when you're settling into a final dose, get the measurement of DHEA and its downstream metabolites, make sure everything is within physiologic normal before you decide on whatever dose you're going to use over the long term. We don't want to repeat the early on 50s cortisone debacle where people got so enthusiastic about the use of cortisone, and then of course within just a few years all the bad side effects came rolling in because people were using supraphysiologic doses and the whole thing got a very bad name.
Right. Well, I agree with that, except if somebody's taking a very small dose. For example, if I put somebody on 5 or 10 milligrams, a woman, I don't typically worry about that, Jonathan. Do you worry about it?
Not at 5 to 10 milligrams.
Right.
I'm talking about when we get to the upper edge of the dosage range that you and I mentioned, namely, as you said, 15, 20 milligrams for women. The upper edge for men, I'll usually define at 30 to 40.
Okay. And then, of course, there's autoimmune diseases. We've been seeing some responses. So far, the only clinical reports that I've seen are on the treatment of lupus, and there was some clinical benefit with a dose around 200 milligrams a day. But I've seen dermatomyositis improve. I've seen rheumatoid arthritis improve in two older people with as little as 5 or 10 milligrams of DHEA per day. And I've seen ulcerative colitis improve and a couple other autoimmune conditions. So that's a really exciting prospect that hopefully more research will be done in that area.
Right. Our colleague Davis Lampson has seen upwards of a dozen folks with ulcerative colitis get quite noticeable improvements with physiologic range DHEA. So I agree with you 100% on the treatment of autoimmune disease. The thing I think we're not taking advantage of there in autoimmune disease as much as we should is once we've got the DHEA in at a physiologic dosage range and made sure all is well there, then going on to examine testosterone. As we know, some people will take the DHEA and metabolize it into testosterone, too. And so dosing with DHEA takes care of both DHEA and testosterone.
And there may actually be a separate effect of testosterone, which has powerful effects of its own. And I know Dr. Bland always finds articles before I do, but here's one from Annals of Rheumatic Diseases, which just happens to be on my desk now from 1996. And they showed that testosterone improves general health in postmenopausal women with active rheumatoid arthritis. So they finally are getting this into the literature.
So once we're done with the DHEA, what I'll do then is turn to measuring testosterone and push that to the top of the normal range for the respective sex, usually, obviously not too much for women. And that gives us a further improvement with our autoimmune disease that we don't get with the DHEA, unless, of course, that person is a very efficient DHEA metabolizer and makes lots of testosterone out of their DHEA.
Could you guys fill us in as to your experience or thoughts about pregnenolone, which is a couple steps upstream from DHEA? How do you see this playing a role, if at all?
Of course, there's the famous article on giving the mice 100 molecules per mouse or something like that of pregnenolone and their memories improved. And that got everyone all excited, even though it had never been done in humans. Of course, there's reason to suspect that it might be helpful in humans. The nervous system has been found to synthesize its own steroids and all that. I'm still being a little cautious with it. The first two people who I was aware of got on the pregnenolone bandwagon, and wanted to go with taking some of it, I asked them to do the 24-hour urine for just a general steroid profile before they did. So those two folks dutifully turned the test in, took the pregnenolone, and in their cases, these two folks, husband and wife, not blood-related though, of course, took only 10 milligrams apiece, and then a couple of months later, they turned in another urinary steroid profile, and doggone it, if all their steroids hadn't dropped. And they said they didn't feel any better either. They didn't feel any worse, but they didn't feel any better. I don't know whether a feedback inhibition mechanism kicked in or what, but it told me that things weren't quite as simple as I would like. So what I'm doing now, Alan does tell me I tend to get a little lab heavy, but what can I say, is asking folks to do exactly that. Check their 24-hour urinary steroids, then go ahead and take their pregnenolone and then check it again to make sure that they get a nice rise in everything, but nothing rises too high and that we don't get that feedback inhibition. Now, I am aware of another woman I'm working with who, prior to the advent of pregnenolone, even in the compounding pharmacies, back in the, whenever it happened, I was working with her back in the 80s, and the poor lady had to take triple estrogen, progesterone, DHEA, testosterone. She had to take every steroid molecule you could name just to keep herself going. She had a bad case of autoimmune problems and asthma. Well, when pregnenolone came out, in her case, we did the measurements. She went on pregnenolone, and she felt substantially better, and without changing the rest of her steroid she was taking at the time, we were being careful. She did a follow-up 24-hour urinary steroid, and sure enough, everything had risen enough that we could back off a few of her other supplements, and pregnenolone apparently flowed, or whatever the verb is, down the chain and turned itself into enough other steroids that it did herself some good. But what I think I'm saying there is we can't count on it to always do that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Conceptually, we try to treat the farthest downstream that we can with hormones. For example, we don't like to give ACTH injections when somebody needs adrenal support. The higher up on the chain you are, the less control you have over what's going on. And in this situation, there's virtually no research on pregnenolone, not to say that it's not effective, but I agree that caution is indicated at this point.
Well, Dr. Gaby, you talked earlier about Keeshan disease and selenium and cardiomyopathy. Maybe we should talk about another nutritional agent that's in the news that has some relationship to cardiac function and cardiomyopathies, which is coenzyme Q10 and the whole relationship to mitochondrial electron transport defects.
Sure.
Your experience in that area?
Well, I wasn't aware that it was in the news. I thought everybody was ignoring it. At least it's not in the medical news. I think it's an incredible compound. There are numerous studies out there now. Probably the most exciting recently was the just two anecdotal reports, but they were very powerful on the regression of metastatic breast cancer in two patients that took very high doses, 390 milligrams a day. One of them had breast cancer with multiple liver metastases, and they completely disappeared in 6 months, and shortly thereafter the woman was described in being in excellent health. And the other had metastases to the pleural cavity, which also disappeared and was perfectly healthy as far as they could tell 11 months later. These are reversals that are publishable no matter what kind of treatment is done, because you just don't see that. And then there was another exciting report about 1993, a journal called Clinical Investigator. It's amazing that they have to find these obscure journals to get these things published. But it was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, large-scale trial using approximately 150 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q10 for patients with congestive heart failure. And there was a statistically significant reduction in the number of hospitalizations. There were 38% fewer in the CoQ group compared to the placebo group. And this was highly significant. Other studies, about five or six, have shown the same results without control groups. But the bottom line there is we have an amazingly effective treatment, which has been shown to triple or quadruple the lifespan of people with cardiomyopathy. It probably would prevent heart transplants in the majority of those people. And that's, as you know, $250,000 operation. So there's just some really exciting things that can be done. There's a little bit of work on cutting down hypertension. Some treatment of periodontal disease with coenzyme Q10 has been shown to be successful. And a small open trial with seven AIDS patients, who five of whom ceased to have opportunistic infections and their T-cell counts came up. As you mentioned, Jeff, this is a cofactor in the electron transport chain. And the electron transport chain is one of the most fundamental mechanisms of energy production, which is at the root of virtually every biochemical process in the body. They have demonstrated that tissue deficiencies occur For example, they've done heart biopsies of people with congestive heart failure, and their coenzyme Q10 level is depleted. And then when they supplement them orally, the level comes up in addition to their function improving.
Jonathan, anything to add on CoQ?
Only Dr. Folker's observations at one of the last ACAM meetings. Let's make sure to have folks take their CoQ10 and a lipid base. Dr. Folker's reported a significant increase in blood levels with the same number of milligrams if it's used in a lipid-containing gel cap rather than as a dry powder.
We're talking a little now about vascular function, and one of the nutrients that always comes to light in this area and also has relationships to mitochondrial energy production is L-carnitine. Any experience that you have with carnitine?
Carnitine's pretty good stuff, too. It's a little bit on the expensive side, but I've seen it work for people with symptomatic heart failure. I've also seen it improve lipid levels, but paradoxically, in some cases, it makes the lipid levels worse. There seem to be two different subclasses of both cardiovascular disease. It's also been shown in people with intermittent claudication due to atherosclerosis of the legs. A fairly high percentage of them improve with carnitine, but some of them actually get slightly worse. And there is a test that you can do. You can measure serum carnitine after exercise, whether it rises. Actually, I don't remember what the exact algorithm was, but there is a way to predict who are the best candidates for carnitine therapy. Probably the most dramatic treatment there is in the treatment of cardiogenic shock, which is a highly fatal condition where they get severe hypotension after an infarction. Normally the mortality rate is about 75%. In one study they tried intravenous carnitine for a number of days at the onset, and they brought the mortality rate down to about 25%. This was done in Italy. It hasn't been looked at here yet.
Right. We have a kind of a core group of nutrients in our protocols that we presented at our seminar for supporting the heart, and those include, as you're leading into, CoQ10, L-carnitine, taurine, and a good source of magnesium, such as the aspartate or taurate.
One of the things I recall seeing in the last year was a very interesting study looking at chronic fatigue syndrome patients. These were pretty dramatically impaired CFIDS patients and their supplementation with carnitine. And I happened to check in on the World Wide Web at the CFIDS Action Group on the web and found that a lot of people were discussing anecdotally their experiences with carnitine. Have either of you seen anything with carnitine and fatigue-related disorders?
No, I haven't myself. The thing I found very most helpful over and over in fatigue-related disorders is to check the fasting plasma essential amino acids. I don't seem to need to go further than the essential amino acids panel. In other words, I don't need to go to a 40 panel or something like that. And then I've been observing that the large majority of chronic fatigue folks are either just flat out deficient in anywhere from 3 to 7 of the essential amino acids, or they're just skirting the very, very low edge of normal with those essential amino acids. What we do then is to have compounded at our favorite compounding pharmacist a group of the amino acids. We include all 8 essential amino acids, but we go the heaviest on the ones that are the lowest, of course, and the lightest on the ones that are most towards normal. And, of course, it's weighted according to the amount of amino acid that appears in a so-called idealized protein. And if that's a little confusing, I'm sorry, I can't do that more quickly. But anyway, the compounding pharmacist knows how to make it up. And then we have them take this compound of essential amino acids that is pretty much matched in a lock-and-key fashion to their own blood test. That's been the amino acid treatment that over and over people with chronic fatigue tell me helps them significantly. Now, I'm not certainly going to say, oh, my goodness, this cures the situation. It doesn't. But what it does get back to me in the way of reports is, yes, I noticed a difference when I took that. I got a significant improvement, even if I'm not entirely better. What I'm assuming is that people can take those essential amino acids that they happen to be low in and metabolize them into many other things that they may need. I'm not assuming here a genetic defect. If I were doing that, I'd run the 40 amino acid panel.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything on carnitine either there, but certainly lysine is the precursor. And I would guess that if your essential amino acids are out of whack, the synthesis of carnitine in the body might be a problem. And in addition, a lot of people with chronic fatigue syndrome are hypochlorhydric, and they probably don't digest the carnitine from their meat properly, and probably don't have enough of the vitamin cofactors because of that hypochlorhydria in order to synthesize carnitine. So based on what we know about the effect of carnitine on metabolism, it wouldn't surprise me if that would help.
Let me, if I can, close, because I know you guys could go on with this, and in fact, you do. You go on for many days in your course that you have the tapes of, and we're going to find out where to get those in a moment. But if I could close this interview with the Bert Berkson interview that we had in Preventive Medicine Update last year, which was probably one of the most responded to clinicians that we've had for some time. And he spoke about his discovery of thioctic acid or lipoic acid and its effect in Amanita mushroom poisoning in humans. Could you tell us about any experience you've had with lipoic acid?
Well, not with Amanita mushrooms, but certainly with people who have had elevated liver enzymes, who have had one or another strong stressor on the liver. Lipoic acid has been, in the people I've worked with, a major help there. We'll usually ask them to use the 100 milligrams three times a day type dosage. Of course, as you know, JAF articles have come out too for the use of lipoic acid to inhibit glycosylation in diabetes, perhaps, and also to work on diabetic neuropathy. Now there, I only have two folks who are launched into taking the lipoic acid for the neuropathy, and it's early innings, but they think it's helping. The articles are good, though, aren't they, Alan?
Well, it was uncontrolled studies, but it's pretty hard to reverse diabetic neuropathy, and they got some good results.
Well, I think we have consumed probably more time than you gentlemen have, and I, for that, really want to thank you for giving us your time. I know that there will be many, many questions and follow-up, and many of our subscribers are people who are just starting into their learning curve, and the wealth of information you have to share they would love to get to, which includes both the tapes of your teaching course and your newsletter, which I and most all of us subscribe to. Could you tell us where they could follow up on that information?
Yes. The tapes from the most recent four-day seminar, which includes reference material and a large citation manual, can be obtained by calling area code 206-854-4900, extension 166. Newsletter, it's called Nutrition and Healing. It's a monthly newsletter, and subscription information can be obtained by calling 1-800-528-0559.
For those of your listeners, Jeff, who are just starting into the learning curve, as you mentioned, one of the things that reference material that goes with the four-day seminar tape set contains are what might be called new protocols for the treatment of various ailments, listings of the nutrients that we have found most useful, along with dosages, I believe,
yes.
So that if one is new at this and wants to know, well, what might they consider for the treatment of a certain problem? I think there are approximately 90 conditions covered, aren't there, Alan?
Yes.
Well, I'm sure that you're going to be getting a lot of response from our listeners around the world, and I want to thank you once again for both your contributions to the evolution of the field and for spending this time with us, and I hope we can check in again for another session of Jazz.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you both. I want to follow up from the comments of Dr. Wright and Gaby concerning this selenium story. I think there are some very exciting things that are happening in the scientific literature related to selenium, which not too many years ago was considered only to be a toxic element. In fact, Dr. Frost visited me when I was a professor at the University of Puget Sound back in the early 1970s, who is a world-renowned selenium expert and had published many papers on the role of selenium as a toxic element, producing increased risk to cancer and to other very serious health problems in animals who got excessive selenium. And at that point in the early 1970s, necessity of selenium as an essential trace element in humans was still in its early understanding, and it's interesting to see how we have really come to now recognize that there are people who could be selenium insufficient, and even therapeutic doses of selenium beyond that of the traditional dietary requirements might be considered beneficial in certain cases. The recent understanding of that was certainly highlighted by the study in the New England Journal of Medicine on selenium that we discussed in Functional Medicine Update earlier. This was the December 25th article, which was then reported also in the Journal of the American Medical Association, that found significant reductions in certain cancer incidents among individuals using 200 micrograms of selenium supplementation for more than 4 years. These are researchers at the University of Arizona, Tucson, who found that people who were taking the selenium supplements for those that took a placebo had 63% fewer cases of prostate cancer, 58% fewer colon or rectal cancers, and 45% fewer lung cancers. Furthermore, the selenium group suffered 50% fewer cancer deaths overall than the placebo group. These findings spark hope for all of us engaged in the battle against cancer. Dr. Barbara Levine, Ph.D., R.D., Director of the Nutrition Information Center at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center, was reported as saying, "We're particularly excited that the study used a selenium supplement so that the potential benefits can be able to be controlled carefully." So I think that the selenium surprise is probably, for those following the story over many years, not that big of a surprise, but for those who are new to the field of functional or nutritional medicine, this might be quite a surprise. Tim Byers, who's a professor of preventive medicine at the University of Colorado Denver, was recently quoted as saying that this is the most exciting finding we have ever had in nutrition and cancer as it relates to this selenium discovery. More than a decade ago, researcher Larry Clark, then at Cornell University, launched a study with colleagues Gerald Combs and Bruce Turnbull, and their goal was to see if the selenium supplements could, in fact, reduce skin cancers from people in the southwest United States, where this is a very serious risk. In that particular study, it didn't. Selenium supplementation had no effect on the recurrence of skin cancer, said Clark, now at the Arizona Cancer Research Center at the University of Arizona in Tucson. But, however, as I pointed out, the JAMA study in reviewing the data indicated the total cancer incidence and the three leading sites of cancer, lung, prostate, and colon, did all decrease and remarkably decrease by roughly 50%. So this is pretty extraordinary. Could the results be too good to be true? Well, that's a very interesting question, and Dr. Walter Willett from the Harvard School of Public Health and a world-renowned epidemiologist was saying, from what we could see, there wasn't anything wrong with the study, but it's almost too good to be true. If the effect is this large, it would be more important than anything else we know about in cancer prevention, end quote. And therefore, this selenium study, again, I want to go back and remind you of the dose that we're talking about, because the provisional estimated daily intake for selenium is 50 to 100 micrograms, and this was 200 micrograms of selenium taken daily for more than 4 years in this particular study. It appears as if selenium at that level has the ability to prevent cancer at levels that are extraordinarily surprising. It's also interesting to remind us that there is a very different selenium content of the diet depending upon the regions of the country you come from. There are areas where selenium in the soil is reasonably high, and then there are other areas of the country where selenium is very inadequate or very low. Grains that are grown in regions of the country where low soil selenium is found have low grain selenium. This is much of eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, with eastern Washington being a big grain-producing area, which has a fairly low soil selenium content. Also, regions of the Dakotas are found to have low soil selenium, and so we may have in some of our grains, our breads, and our other cereal products fairly low selenium to begin with, which then further aggravates the problem. In a recent paper that was published in Redox Report, Volume 2, page 323 in 1997, it was found that selenium supplementation was also found to have a very powerful ability to decrease the pro-oxidant effect of adriamycin in an animal study and to help protect against cardiotoxicity. Some of you know that vitamin E has been studied extensively in animals as a cardioprotective agent against adriamycin toxicity. This would seem to indicate that selenium also plays a role in this regard as well, and that the two of them work synergistically. This is not to be unexpected because, as you know, selenium activates the enzyme glutathione peroxidase, which regenerates or is actively involved in the glutathione disulfide cycle. And therefore, selenium insufficiencies may result in depleted glutathione activities, which then results in a greater depletion of vitamin E. So vitamin E and selenium work together to give rise to improved protection against free radical oxidant damage and elicit antioxidant protection against potential cardiotoxic oxidants or carcinogens. So I think the selenium story that was discussed by Drs. Wright and Gaby is a very interesting story that is emerging to have some significant both preventive and potential therapeutic implication. Dr. Orville Levander, who is the gentleman that did the selenium and Coxsackie virus study, who is at the USDA research station, has been actually looking at trace elements and their role on cellular defense mechanisms for more than 20 years. He was the person who first did the studies on lead intoxication and the effects they had on blood pressure, showing that lead would create the increased oxidative stress in red cell membranes, producing a tanning of the membranes and lose their flexibility so that they could not squeeze themselves through capillaries as efficiently. And as a consequence, rheological resistance would increase and blood pressure would increase. More recently, however, he's looked at this influence of low selenium in the diet and its effects on mutation of the Coxsackie virus, as was described by Dr. Wright, and showing that that effect is then passed on through subsequent generations through increasing mutational rates of change and increasing virulence of various viruses. So obviously, selenium plays multiple roles in the immunological system, the cardiovascular system, in the general antioxidant system, and it may also play an important role as an anti-tumor agent. We would like to close this month with kind of an aside as it pertains to the story that we discussed earlier with insulin insensitivity, and that has to do with the effect that insulin insensitivity has on the oxidative stress mechanisms of the body. When insulin is high and the body is working overtime to try to manage glucose, there is increasing potential for glycosylation, increasing insulin-driven effects on gene expression, including the expression of nuclear factor kappa B, the oxidant stress element, and therefore oxidant stress increases in these situations. Therefore, insulin resistance and atherosclerosis may be in part tied together through the understanding of the role that that plays in increasing oxidative damage to LDL and other blood and arterial components that increases the risk to atherogenesis. We're also going to learn next month in Functional Medicine Update that this interrelates with satiety and neurohormones like leptin and how that relates to insulin-modulated obesity. I think that this concept of metabolic obesity and our understanding of the control of insulin resistance and how that can help to manage aspects of metabolic obesity is opening up whole new doors for therapeutic benefit for patients who may have been refractory to other weight management programs and who have been told the simple-mindedness that just eat less and you'll lose weight. This concept of just eating less in a person who has interruption in their metabolic control of thermogenesis may in fact not be an acceptable or even a satisfactory answer to their tendency to gain energy as stored fat for a rainy day that never comes. We will be talking a lot about how breakthroughs have occurred recently in the field of bariatrics, which is the science of obesity management, probably the most significant breakthroughs that have happened in the last 20 years. The first of these is the finding that the neurotransmitter serotonin controls in part carbohydrate hunger and its relationship, therefore, to overeating. The second is the discovery that there is an anti-obesity protein called leptin produced by the body interrelated with insulin sensitivity that helps to regulate body fat. These discoveries have resulted in a search for drugs that will help control the serotonin connection to obesity or mimic the activity of leptin. From this research, fenfluramine, or the FinFin program, which modulates serotonin and appetite, has become the first drug for weight loss to be approved by the Food and Drug Administration. At the same time, clinical studies are underway to evaluate the effectiveness of leptin in controlling obesity. However, both these approaches have run into problems with the discovery that in some individuals, fenfluramine may result in life-threatening pulmonary hypertension, and leptin administration might contribute to the development of diabetes, increasing insulin insensitivity. Therefore, if we can find natural ways of improving insulin sensitivity, controlling carbohydrate hunger, and balancing thermogenesis, it would be desirable without having to rely upon exogenous agents. It's also interesting to note that in insulin-insensitive individuals, it has been found that they are also leptin-insensitive. So giving them leptin often only aggravates the problem. It doesn't improve the problem. So we shouldn't assume that all individuals who are obese with metabolic obesity are low leptin secretors. We may have people that are hyperleptin secretors, and they are leptin-insensitive. So we need to find ways of balancing hormone sensitivity and improving thermogenesis, and that comes back to controlling insulin and its receptivity and also controlling oxidative stress reactions. Next issue, we will talk about dietary protein carbohydrate ratios and balancing insulin levels and the relationship to leptin and to thermogenesis. And we'll also talk about how that relates then to new methods of dietary intervention utilizing what one would call amino acid balancing, resistant starch, higher soluble fiber diets, and improved trace minerals, particularly chromium and vanadium. So hold true to the story, and we will talk more about it in the May issue of Functional Medicine Update.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.